Today is the 25th of June. I am interviewing Nancy and Tony Morrissey.
Could you tell me your full name?
Dennis Anthony Morrissey.
And your date of birth?
9th of the 10th, 1936. I'm called Tony. Except when I go to official places where I've got to give them a correct name, and then I did get Dennis at work. But most others I took Tony, the name I was called.
Where were you born? What place?
I was born at Rosebery, in a home at Rosebery, Asquith Avenue, Rosebery. I'm sure it was. But I don't remember any part of Rosebery because as a baby we moved from there to Zetland, to Elizabeth Street, Zetland, where I was to live until I got married in 1959.
Your full name and your former name, if you can remember that one too.
Oh, yes, barely. Nancy Leslie Morrissey. Single name was Darnley. Date of birth, 16th of the November, 1938. I was born at Crown Street Women's Hospital, and my family lived in Young Street, Waterloo, till I was about 14. We moved up to Beecroft for a year, lived up there for a year, and then my father bought a butcher shop at Randwick and lived there until I was married in 1959. At Sacred Heart Church at Randwick on the 7th of February.
Can you talk to me about where you lived there before moving to the valley, so you lead up to that?
When we were married, we moved into a couple of rooms in the back of a house in Annandale, Trafalgar Street, Annandale, and we lived with a Scottish couple. We lived there for 2 years. Then we left there for a year and went to live with Tony's cousin and his auntie Elsie and Patricia. And we were there with them for 12 months. And then we moved back to the house in Annandale because the people that we were living with were going to Scotland. They needed someone to mind the house. So we stayed there for another 2 years before we got the house up here at Green Valley.
And you moved to Green Valley...
Moved to Green Valley the 14th of February 1964.
Where do you live in Green Valley? Have you always lived in this house?
Yes. We moved into this house. It had been occupied for a couple of months prior, so we weren't the original occupants of this house. The family that was in here were having, the wife in particular was having problems. Her husband was in the building game and he was working on a site at Coogee Way, and subsequently he was going very early of a morning and getting home when it was dark of a night, and I'm not sure how many children they had, but she just wasn't coping, so they had to move out. I actually got a phone call at work from the manager of the rural bank. The House Commission had been in touch with him. He was made aware that these people were moving out and their loan was going to be affected. And the deal was that if we agreed to, we could take the house, take over the loan, and refund this guy his deposit or his bond, if that was satisfactory to us. So I had we had a chance to come up and just have a look at it. And that in itself took a bit of doing. Green Valley was made in such a way that nearly every intersection was a T-intersection. Because they were aware so many children were going to be in the area, and they wanted to make sure they were given as much protection as possible, which was a very excellent idea. Well, there wasn't many maps around in those days, and it was Les and I, wasn't it, came up and had a look. You and Mum, yeah. Mm. And it was very difficult to find. And the first couple, I think both was the first trips we came here, it took a bit of finding, you know. What should have been 5 or 6 minutes was a lot longer than that.
What were some of your early memories around arriving here? What did you first feel about?
Oh, when we first arrived here, I think when we moved in, As Tony said, we were the last in this particular part of Green Valley to move in. Other people had been in since about the November, December, and we didn't move in until February. And we did, Tony took holidays, and I can remember we used to sort of look out our window and we'd see all the people, the women, talking over the fence. They used to have a lovely time over the side fence and having a talk. And I think that was because the husbands would go off to work and go very early in the morning and wouldn't get home too late. So, you know, we were quite fascinated with that in the beginning because having come from Annandale, you didn't see that. You didn't see people sort of leaning over their front fences or hopping over or even standing in their dressing gowns and talking to each other after their husbands had gone off to work. So that was one of the first things. And I think the heat, because we moved in the February and it was just so hot with what we'd been used to in the eastern suburbs and around Annandale. I think that must have been the hottest summer we've ever experienced, but we've probably had worse, but because that was our first. And then, of course, once winter came, the same thing. We thought that was the coldest winter we've ever experienced, but same reason. We just weren't used to this climate. But after 12 months, 2 years, we soon adjusted to that.
How did you keep cool?
How do we keep cool?
That first
heat. Oh, with great difficulty. I can remember closing blinds and curtains as soon as we got up in the morning and locking the place up to keep the heat out. Being a brick house, it did tend to keep the heat there. And then, of course, once night came, you sort of opened it up and tried to get a bit of cool air. But we had little tiny fans and, yeah, it was very difficult.
No sea breeze out here, is there?
No, it's a bit far.
Not at all.
A bit far, yeah.
Kerosene heater?
For heating.
For the heating, that was about, you know, the first I can remember. And of course, the smell of kerosene was ever present. I think someone said about the pot of water, if you sat that on the grill, that helped... I don't know what it did. It evaporated the caro and took the smell out of the air, you know, it did something like that. And Nance was saying about the women, you know, over the fence. Well, majority of people that came here moved from South Sydney, Balmain and Newtown area. And they already had established jobs. And, of course, their jobs were fairly close by to that area, most of them. So come winter, even office worker like myself, you sort of just about left in the dark and got home in the dark. That was one of the hardest things I think I found. And later on, as the kids got a bit older, there was just no time, you know. It was quite depressing. I didn't think of it at the time, but I can understand now why that woman was having trouble coping, because if her man was going at 4:30 in the morning and not getting back at dark at night, that was a hell of a long day for her. And, you know, there was, Nance said fences, but they were only those little foot-high fences, you know, and so they were, unless most people didn't put up any erect fences in those days, they utilised what the housing commissioner put in. Now, if you've got young kids running around, it was very hard to keep an eye on them, very hard to keep them, you know, corralled. There was a lot of red clay around on the ground. it was difficult to work with. And that's sort of the stark memories. At the same time, there was the elation that you're in your house, you know, you're in your house. So there's a lot of that was probably a lot of the adjustments to be made. The feeling was overcome because, you know, it was sort of ours. Definitely the weather was hard to cope with. It took a few years to really, before I think most of us can become acclimatised. So rain was very difficult. When it rained, it was extremely difficult. You know, I mean, you dare not walk on a bare patch because you'd slip over. You would actually slip over. There was, it was, as I mentioned, it was that clay ground. It was very ugly. And the front of our, the lawn, the front here, to the left as you look in at it, had been used as a storage dump for gravel, sand and a few other things from the building area. So we still had a... And mind you, like, that blue metal's been turned up even to the latter years. Pieces of blue metal keep turning up. It was unbelievable how much keep turning up. I just thought they must have been one of those mixers down below was, you know, sending up all the time. And that's I think the initial memories, things that's come to mind, stuck in the mind.
How much furniture did you have when you got here?
We had a fridge. We had bought a fridge. We had a bed. We had an old lounge. And Tony's mother had always been going to buy us a really good wedding present and had kept putting it off. And she actually bought us, and I know she bought it through Walton's or whatever and paid it off, but she bought us a dining room suite and a buffet. So we did have that. We had a dining room suite and a buffet, and we had the fridge and a bed and a very old lounge. And we had an old TV, very old TV. And we had on the floor, we just had the... we had had someone come in and sand it for us because we knew we wouldn't have any money for carpets. So we had the floor sanded and just some vinyl. Actually, my brother-in-law was in the building game and he gave us some vinyl tiles, which I laid. I laid in the kitchen and the laundry and the bathroom. So, and curtains. I think we sort of went to the expense, not curtains. We bought Holland blinds. We actually bought Holland blinds and put those all around the place. We didn't have curtains, but at least we had some window covering. Because we're very isolated too, in as far as transport and communication. Our nearest phone box, because there were no phone cables, we put applications in for phone, and we had to wait a couple of years. And our nearest phone box when we moved in here was, I think, over at Ashcroft, which was a little while away. The bus, that was our nearest shop, and it was only a small shop. And the bus used to come down as far as Bobbin Road and what is now the Sadler's shops, but there weren't any shops there at the time. So to do any shopping, you'd have to walk down to the shops, to the stop, and then get the bus into Liverpool and do your grocery shopping, bring it back on the bus. A bit later on, when we did get a phone on, I can remember getting hold of the grocery store's number and would ring him up and he would actually deliver groceries. We had a butcher used to come round and take an order, so that was good. And, of course, we had everyone coming around with their bells, the greengrocer and, of course, the ice cream man the kids loved. And that was what we saw a lot of too, a lot of kids. Everyone had children. And so there was, you know, always two, three, four children in every house. So, our children had plenty of playmates. And I guess the women, even though we were isolated, I guess we probably had it a little better than the men in as much as we were able to make friends. Because we were home of a day, we really couldn't do anything. We just had the children. And you did make friends with your neighbours. And there were the times when we'd have morning teas and go to each other's place or something and have a morning tea. I think now they would sort of have a glass of wine. Or we'd go and have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. So I guess the women made friends quicker than the men because you had to. You didn't have anyone here. And I can remember, from being up here with one child and being pregnant with another one, and then once I had the other one, going from here down to Kensington to play tennis. And I would walk down the road here and get on the bus with the pusher and whatever, and take the bus into Liverpool, get the train from Liverpool to Central, and get a bus from Central out to Kensington, and walk up the hill to where the tennis courts were, play tennis or miss and giggle for a couple of hours, and then do the return trip, and before the peak hour. I'd hate to try and do it now.
So, Tony, can you describe a working day, what time you'd start, and then you can go into a bit about where you worked? And when you get home, how long would it take?
The working day for me at the particular time, I'm pretty sure was either 10 to 9 to 10 to 5. I'm pretty sure my hours were. It became a bit variable later on down the track, when the businesses start to change, you know, allow this change took place. But at that point of time, was 10 to 9 to 10 to 5. Now for a fair while, there was a couple of trains, steam trains, that ran. But it was a while before I was aware of the one from Mossvale. So let's see, I'd have to leave home somewhere by 7 o'clock in the morning, about 7 o'clock in the morning, wasn't it? Yeah. To get to work, to start work at 10 to 9. There wouldn't be much change. Fortunately, there was about a 10-minute variance for each connection, 5 to 10 minutes variance, because you needed it. Things just never seemed to run on timetable in those days. Getting home, well, knocking off at 10 to 5, it wouldn't be before up past 6, somewhere between up past 6 and about 10 to 7. So even in your summer, without daylight saving hadn't come in then, there wasn't much change. There was no daylight available. So it was quite a, I mean, if, there was a time I suppose it went through, it was quite a bit of a novelty. But that soon wore off, you know, because it really became a bit of a, what's the word? Oh, not a drag, but it became, you know, quite tiresome. And you get the, even in those days, you know, there wouldn't always guarantee you, especially when I used to knock off, no guarantee I'd get a seat. Most likely I wouldn't get a seat at Town Hall, having get on a train then. You wouldn't get a seat. Well, you wouldn't get a seat. You started the running up from somewhere from Merrylands onwards. Most of our trains ran along that branch in those days, the Granville branch rather than the Regent Parks branch. Later on, that was the change. You know, I go up to Museum, get the train, do the loop. When they start doing the loop around Circular Quay. But prior to that, the trains used to run straight across to North Sydney and come back that way from North Sydney. But then they started getting other trains that ran the City Circle Loop, and that was much better. I always go up and get a seat at Museum. And that was that. I think that was the thing that Therese. That was the hardest part. The travelling time was one thing, but you quite often you go to sleep on the train if you've got a seat, or you talk to someone, you know. But just the fact that when you were leaving home in that semi darkness, if it wasn't dark, and getting home in the same way, so the whole you just the, you know just got to get to you a bit. The day's gone, and you don't spend any of it at home.
So I know, I'm very aware you both have a long history of community involvement in Green Valley, and I'd like to start exploring that. Tony, I know that you were involved in AA within the Green Valley community. Maybe we can talk about the situation that led you up to AA briefly, and we'll take it from there, and some of the people that were supportive towards you and...
Sure. In the previous one about transport to and from work, I mean, well, you know, and in our family movements up here, I think there was another factor, which was starting to unfold towards the climax, if we will say, and that was my drinking. It had caused a fair bit of problems or friction, if not problems, here, there, and everywhere. I think one of the things that if Nance and I had arguments over it, which did take place, the one factor that was seemed to override anything else, which I guess I took advantage of, was that society would have you believe that if you only drank beer, you really couldn't get any problems with alcohol, with grog. Well, you know, I know today that how wrong that is, and I mean, I was dispelled that myself because I was only wanted to drink beer. Now, the reason was that I'd overheard a conversation with my father and some of his mates at one time, I don't know, around about 16 or 17, I guess, and that's exactly what they said. You know, if you stick to beer, you can't get in any trouble. And I can remember identifying people in the area. They had problems because of what they drank. There was a guy who lived across the road from us, and he was a non-beer drinker. He'd drink, and just every so often he'd go off his brain. There wasn't much of him. By gee, it seemed to always take a good few coppers to control him. He'd really go off at the deep end sometimes and start, he'd pick up something and start wheeling it. And, you know, and then time to time he actually hit someone in the family with it. And that's what I thought his problem was. I thought the ones in the parks and that were the army cats and that, because they drank plonk or they drank spirits. And that was the problem. So, you know, I went through a period, I think, where I was kidding myself, and I was dirty on the world, and I was just using that as an excuse to drink and drink, you know, on another occasion. I sort of thought I'd played the game fairly fair, and yet, you know, what was going wrong? If you drank beer, you didn't belch your wife, you went to work and took some money home, you know, well, everything was rosy. Well, everything wasn't rosy, and to get to, without, you know, the too many details, there were various times in my life where things would go really wrong. I remember one occasion I finished up at South Sydney Hospital. I was working out at Epsom Road, Rosebery, and one of the doctors there, I think he was the superintendent actually, I didn't know till much later on, when I actually got to AA, he had picked me, because he wrote a word that I didn't connect. I saw the one word, but I didn't connect, and the word he wrote was primary. And I had no idea what he wrote, because I was only about 22 or 23 at the time. We weren't long married. We were living at Annandale. And I didn't connect. Anyway, it was causing more and more problems, and I wasn't getting home in time, and I was missing here and there. And I mean, there were some funny occasions, like going to sleep in the blessed train and waking up at Penrith Station up past 1 in the morning and having to get from there to here, and the only way was by taxi, and that happened twice a week apart. There was a guy on the lighter side, there was a guy on the railway station, he looked like, honestly, he looked like Constable Clot, was it, in the what was the name of them cops on the Caper Cops on comedy, on TV. There was a show on that, and this guy was dressed like him and walked like him and all, you know. And the second time I woke up and it's coming in a pen, and I saw the name, no, I don't believe it. And I got off the station, and I was sort of dirty on myself, dirty on the world, and I'm walked on the station, shaking my head, and next thing for me, I heard someone laughing. And this guy said, "Oh, no, not you again, mate." Well, you know, I felt like choking him, but whatever people around, they're all looking at me, not me, and what me again, I don't know what they're going to do. Anyway, I went and see the taxi driver. How am I getting? You get home about that, my friend, wait to get up somehow and get back to work. I don't know how I got away with so long. I don't know how I did it, but it caused a lot of problems. And finally, it was we had a guy present to our work, put in charge of the branch, and part of his job was to clean it up, because the branch I was in, oh boy, I don't know how so many heavy drinkers and alcoholics could be assembled in the one place from within an organisation like the Sydney County Council. But there was a fact that they were there, and this guy named Evan Rockwell looked like about the same size and very, very look alike Joe Bjelke Peterson. And had the same attitude, or might have been more arrogant than Joe. Much more arrogant, this guy. And I mean, he was one, and this is back in 1968, 69. And he was using bad language then. I mean, that wasn't heard of, but he was able to get away because he was commissioned to do this caper. Anyway, he got hold of me. And he shook the life out of me. Now, fortunately for me, this was all, everything, there was a lot of things happening at the time. I was, I guess, what they were in AA, the rock bottom. I'd hit before, I'm sure, but they really hit this time. And anyway, he told me on this. He'd sent me to see everyone. He'd sent me to see the staff office, and I'd get up there, and they'd say, "What do you know? I've got to see you." Who said? I don't want to see you. Mr. Rockwell sent me here. Oh. So he'd sit down, and then half an hour later, go back to work. So then he'd call me his office, and he'd just point the chair in front of his desk. An hour and a half later, you can go outside again now. Wouldn't have said a word in the meantime. And it was extremely nerve-wracking, especially when, I was probably jumping around for a drink too. And he'd done that a number of times. Anyway, this particular, I think on the Friday, he said to me on Monday morning, and there'd been about four trips to various offices in the council. And he said, "You're to go and see the council doctor. He wants to see you on Monday morning." Well, I remember the irony of this was when I came home, it was on my mind, and I don't know, I really can't remember what I said much to Nancy at the time. But for some reason, I remember thinking to myself, vaguely as it is, but the council doctor's going to find out how much alcohol I got in my system. That's what I really, I thought he was going to test me, test my blood, the main thing. And it didn't connect at the time. It didn't connect. I'm thinking this way, yeah, but I'm still thinking I'm not alcoholic. The weekend was rather quiet for me. I had quite a weekend. I just wasn't, And the Monday morning I got as far as Liverpool Station, looked up the steps and turned around and said, I just couldn't go on. Then I got a very crazy bloody idea come to mind. Maybe it was the beer after all. So I went back to the early open, the Golden Fleece Hotel, which I hadn't been there first time that morning, which I used to frequent and had been doing for a couple of years quite often, if not every morning, just about. And I went in and I ordered drinks, and I was ordering drinks by colour because I had no idea what they were called or anything. Well, by mid-afternoon, they just had a natural effect. They made me drunk. Didn't solve any problem. And that particular afternoon, I think around about 3:45, I got barred from the Green Valley Hotel, playing some game of euchre, which I don't recall, except that I do recall briefly having a bit of a blue with the... It happened to be my partner, not the opposition, and Mrs. West, who was there at the time, she bade me farewell. And the funny thing about it, I was only saying to Nance recently, I did keep part of my bargain, because I told her what to do with the hotel and I'd never be back. Well, the hotel's still there, but I never went back drinking, because that was to turn out to be the last day I had a drink. I can recall being in the Stop and Rest Hotel, no idea to this day how I got there, no idea, and a bloke talking to me, a guy named John Carter, who lives up the hill, and he knew me, and he suggested I get out of the pub and he'll take me home. And I knew then that was a good idea, because I couldn't stand the one spot and people are coming in from work, knocking off work, and I'm bumping in them and spilling grog on them, and that was the end of the day. And by then, I knew that everything had just caved in. My whole life had caved in right in front of me. So John brought me home, and at this point I might, perhaps give Nancy a go, and then she can tell you more about what happened that night than I really remember. You and Father?
Prior to that, when Tony was saying about recognising whether he was alcoholic, no one can say that anyone else is alcoholic, but I think really, I would have known for a long while. And the part that was, I used to take him, by this time we had a car, very old car, but a car, and I used to drive him to the station of an afternoon, every morning, and pick him up for an afternoon. And it got to the stage where I would take him to the station, and then sometime through the day, perhaps he might ring me or I might ring him. But then a couple of times when I rang him, he wasn't at work. So I started to get a little bit suspicious, because he'd come home blind drunk and whatever, or didn't arrive home, or I wouldn't know where he was. And then it got to a stage where I'd take him to the station and I would wait to see if he got on the train. So quite often I would see him going to the early opener. and I'd wait there for a bit longer, of course I had all the kids in the car with me too. So we'd wait there a bit longer to see if he did get on the train, and, you know, once I'd see him go up those steps at the station, I'd breathe easy. I think, well, he's gone to work. And this particular day that he's talking about, he went up the steps of the station. I thought, oh, he's fine, but I went round the block. Had a suspicious mind, and I think because, you know, I was as sick as he was, the drink had got me to the stage that, you know, I was sort of looking for anything. Anyway, I drove around the block, and when I did, I saw him come back out of the station and go across the early opener. So I knew he wasn't at work. I was frightened to ring work. I kept hoping that he would have been there, but I was frightened to ring, because I thought, if I ring, I put him in, I go, they then say, well, where is he? And so I didn't. So I just had to sweat it out for the day. He rang me, I think, from Liverpool Hotel that day, very blind, and said he'd be home in half an hour. Some hours later, he rang me again from Green Valley Hotel and said he'd be home, and immediately. I waited some hours, and then eventually John Carter did bring him home. By this stage, I was quite upset, and I didn't recognise John Carter, who actually was a friend of ours. And I virtually yelled out, you know, well, you can come in, Tony, but your mate can't. I don't want any of your drunken mates to come in. So he came in and virtually passed out. And I'd had enough. Prior to this, we had been worried about his drinking. We'd even been down to the priest. And Tom went in and had a talk, and the priest had said to him, why don't you try and do what another parishioner did and cut your drinking down, instead of drinking big glasses, drink small ones. So he came straight out of there and went across to the hotel, and the kids and I were sitting in the car, and he had to go in and prove that he could just drink the little ones. He did drink the little ones, but it cost him a whole lot more money, because he had to drink a lot more to still get the effect that the big glasses did. So he tried that. Anyway, knowing he'd had that contact with the priest and spoken to the priest about his drinking, I think that sort of broke the ice for me, and I felt quite confident or whatever in ringing him. So I rang the priest, and he had a talk to him, and he was the first one that sort of said to me, did I think he's alcoholic? And I said, yes. And then, of course, I start to say, well, it's my fault. What have I done? All the guilt bits. And he was great. He was great. And he said, look, I'll get you and put you in touch with someone. So we hung up. And within about 10 minutes, I received a phone call back from Vince Johnson. And Vince Johnson, who lived at Cartwright. Now, he had made himself known to Father Muldoon that he was an alcoholic and was in AA and was willing to help if he heard of anyone that needed help. Now, Vince and I talked at length that night. Tony was dead to the world. He'd passed out. He wouldn't have known if I was talking to anyone or not. So we had a great talk, and then he said, look, he'd try and come around the next day. So the next morning he rang me early and he said, look, I'm still at home today. He was off sick from work, this particular chap. And he said, I'm off today. What about if I come round today? And I said, well, I had to go out at that time to get a little bit of money together, because Tom was in the habit of giving me his wages and keeping a little bit for himself. But throughout the week we'd get most of it back, because he, you know, with these cabs from Penrith, and also he needed money. So I used to mind children at home. And there was a lady down the road who used to do some sewing over at Delta Sportswear over Rideway. And with our little old car, I used to drive her over there, and she would just pay me for petrol and a little bit, a couple of dollars extra for taking her over there. So that was a little way of, you know, getting a little bit of money in. So I'd said to Vince that I did have to go and take Tina across to ride, and he said, well, that's fine. You know, as long as he's there, will he be there? I said, I'm quite sure he won't surface. And I can remember him waking up that morning and wanting to know, would I ring work? Now, Vince on the phone had said to me, you don't make excuses for him. He has to make his own excuses. You stop propping him up. And I said to Vince, oh, now he'll want me to ring work. What do I do? And Vince said, well, you know, you play it how you wish, but you have to stop it sometime. So when Tony asked me this, and I said, well, I'll do it this time, and this will be the last time. I'm not ringing work for you, I'm making excuses for you. You make your own excuses or tell your own lies. I've done it enough. So, which I did, I rang work and told them. And then I went out because I had to go and pick Tina up. And then Tony can take over from there, what happened with Vince.
Yeah, I think my first recollection when I came around was I didn't know where Nance was. I knew she said she would have told me, would expect me to know, but I didn't know. The place was just empty, and it was a bit different. I knew I was going to be in. I was going to be in a bit of strife at work. They had been out here once checking on me when I hadn't turned up for work. And I thought I just didn't know where I was going, what I was doing. But one of the things, what wasn't on me mind right at that point, where could I get a drink from? I was more worried, I was more concerned. I just thought my whole life was, you know, was just gonna disappear on me.
Can I just interrupt there? Were all your children born at this time?
Oh yeah, so yeah. The three boys were born.
Right.
We're talking now. It's. I can tell you. It's the 13th of July, 1970.
Okay.
It's a Monday. No, now it's a Tuesday rather. A Tuesday. That Monday is the day. It was the 14th of July, Tuesday, when I've come around. And then I think I saw this guy come up the thing, or he knocked on the door and I went and had a look. Not real sure, but I do know I looked out and saw a car outside, and I was really expecting someone from the council to be there. And there was this brown-looking, I think it was a Ford Cortina, actually. I don't know what it was, but it was a brown car out the front. And that was the reason I opened the door. It had been a green-coloured car, I don't know what I would have done, because all the council fleet was green. Anyway, I opened the door, and this bloke's there, and you know, one way and another. Anyway, he came in, I let him in. And I'd never seen him before, and he sat down. We sat down in this area here. I just forget. I remember I was sitting in the chair, was in properly that position. Anyway, and he said he'd like to tell me a bit of his life, part of his life. And I remember sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, I don't know this bloke, but how come he knows so much? Who's been telling him about me, you know? I didn't. You know, there was no anger. There was no, because I was just so bloody intrigued. He's telling me about me, and I don't know him. You know, where did he come from? I never even had the common sense at that point of time to say how the bloody hell, like, did you get here or anything. At first, you know, I really don't know much about the first conversation. He said he had to go and see a doctor. Blah blah blah, and after a while. Within half an hour, I remember sitting here crying, and I think, you know, and then I said, you sure, you know, like, you yes? And I said, well, that's me. He said, well, good. So very quickly, we sort of had a bonding, and he said he was going to a meeting that night. Would I like to go with him? Well, I jumped at it, really did. And I don't even remember this point of time now, what point Nancy came back. I can remember, it was a funny feeling. It was a different feeling. I didn't really, and he said to me, look, try not to have a drink today. If it gets too bad, have a drink. It was tough, but it was nothing like it had been previously. I think just knowing that this might be whatever it is, whatever it was. You see, one time I thought about AA. My conception was that that it was some sort of an institution whereby, you know, if you didn't want to be in it, once you got there, they bullied you. They took over. And maybe that came from an instance I had a second cousin of mine or whatever. He was living with us and he was alcoholic. And I hadn't seen him for ages. And one night he turned up outside the Crown Hotel. I came out this probably would have been, I'm not sure if we were married, or I got a feeling we could have been married. I didn't recognise him. There's a guy who had lived in the same house with for a number of years, and he said, and I remember starkly what he said to me. He said, if they ever get old, you don't let them use shock treatment. And sort of disappeared out of my life at that point of time. I don't know what the heck's he talking about. But so I think when I'm thinking later on down the track, AA, I'm thinking that's what happens. See, so I don't want any part of whatever it is. Anyway, Vince came back, took me to Guildford that night. I don't remember too much about the meeting. The next night, he took me to Wednesday night, would have been Liverpool. I can remember coming home and like, we weren't on sort of really talking. Vince. And I remember coming home and, you know, I never even thought about that. I said something to Nance like, I think I've got a chance. I think I know what's wrong with me. And I went from there. I go back to this bloke at work. When I get back to work, I didn't go to work. I went to that meeting on the chest, not now. Came the Wednesday, and I had to, the rules were that you could have 2 days on a stat deck sick leave. But anything like that, you had to get a doctor's certificate. On the Wednesday, I went to see Dr. Yap, and Dr. Taylor was still in his practice then. I think they were still across the road. They were still across the road. And Dr. Yap got me up on a table, examination table. I'm not sure. But anyway, I do want to remember he'd done. And the adjoining door opened, and he asked Dr. Tay to come in. You know, and I'm jumping all around the table. The nerves were shot. And, Dr. Tay, you know, he was more blunt than Yap, really, and Tay said, he'll have to go to Langton Clinic. And I think the bloody mental, the shock treatment and all that. I'm quite adamant. I'm not going to any clinic nor any hospital. I'm not going. Because I really thought that I wouldn't get out. I thought I'd be kept there for whatever. So I asked Dr. Yap if he'd give me a certificate. And he wasn't easy to get a certificate out in those days, Yap, or any days, for a matter of fact. But I did not want to go. So he more or less compromised with me. He said he'd do it, but if I didn't get any better, I'd have to think about doing something. And somehow or other, he gave me the whole week. I needed it. It settled me down enough. I went back to work. This Evan Rockwell called me in. Blah, blah, blah. And I immediately told him that I was going to AA and everything. And I remember he just sat there looking at me, staring at me, you know. And it was a funny thing. It was only that day, I'm pretty sure it was that afternoon. I was looking for something at work, or that week at least. And I found in the clearances, something, you know, they sent everything in those days, it was manual clearances, everything was just passed around. And there was a book been taken out of the library by Mr. Rockwell, and it was, I forget what the book exactly was, but I know the part was on it because I seen it. And it was just, I don't think it was a setup. I think it's just one of those freaky things. The onus, alcoholism, the onus on the employer to the employee. And I had a look at it, and I just read a little, and I'd seen who signed it out, and then signed it to go back, and he never said anything at that point of time, but within a couple of weeks, and by the way, Vince Johnson, and Nance mentioned his surname. Now we wouldn't do this except he's dead. That's, you know, that's the anonymity of AA. That's AA. You only ever use your Christian name. There's a lot of people in AA I've known for many, many years. I've got no idea what their surname is. And it's inconsequential. But we mention his name because he can no longer break the anonymity for Vince. Vince had made sure that I got to meeting every night for a few weeks. It was quite a few weeks. It was probably the best part of a month. And then he was to, I think he told you, didn't he? He was then to make out a pretense he couldn't go to one Monday night. And I took myself to Fairfield meeting. But that was part of the plan too. Vince wanted me to, you know, find my own way to a meeting on my own solo.
That was quite a commitment from Vince for that period of time.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was Vince Johnson.
How did that feel? I mean, how was
that? Oh, it was magic. Yeah. The only trouble was there was a couple of occasions we'd go to a meeting, and one Friday night we'd go to a meeting, and I got home in the morning, the sun is coming up. It was only when I left Vince's place, he lived at Cartwright, just over the bridge, and I walked down, and oh, God, I forgot to tell Nan, you know. We used to leave the meeting, we'd have a yarn after the meeting, and there'd be X amount of us leave a meeting and maybe Vince's place, go there and, like, just keep going on. And just got that carried away. I did not realise the time, you know, and in a sense it was pretty cruel because it was the same bloody thing not coming home again. I never give a second thought. She might have thought, well, oh, shivers, I wonder if he's gone again, you know. Because there was a period, you see, when all was coming up, I tried to get off the grog in that year, in that first 6 months of the year, up to June, July, a number of times. One time I lasted about a week or more. And then one Saturday afternoon, I remember when I left here, and I went down to the Valley Hotel. I was still in the punters club at the time, and I backed a winner. So I went down there to give them the money and everything. And it drank soft drink, but I stayed too long. Drank soft drink for about an hour and a half. And then, yeah, I'll have one beer. So one beer, I remember I finished up with Lenny, what's his name? Lives around near Silks.
Deegan.
Lenny Deegan. And then he used to play the squeeze box. I don't remember how I got in his company, but I finished up with him and the place, and he was singing and drinking. Oh, it was great. But I'm pretty sure it was bloody Sunday before I got home. I finished up at someone else's place, you know. Having a week off the grog or 10 days, whatever it was, you know, it would have freshened me up a bit. But towards the end of my drinking, whereas once upon a time I could drink a fair amount, towards the end, only a few drinks, only a few schooners, and I'd be on my way. And I was starting to get to the tottering stage. I knew something was wrong there. When I was starting to not being able to stand much in the, you know, get the tottering bit, and I'd sit down and, you know, I'd go to sleep and place it. But, oh, there was a few other factors. With alcoholic, the fears had come in, and I couldn't stand to be enclosed area. And, you know, just the fear itself. Didn't know what, you know, nothing. They're looking over your shoulder. And anyway, I knew then that something was drastically wrong, and this was getting towards the finish, because I tried but I knew that I didn't know what was really. It was like a crushing weight now, and I guess, or not realizing that I knew, or not wanting to admit that I couldn't do it on my own, or I still wouldn't admit I'm an alcoholic, as sick as one can get. You still wouldn't finally admit that I was an alcoholic.
How did your mates? Did you discuss it with your mates, or how was their behaviour? Like, you did? Like,
well, a lot of them, as I said, Therese, a lot of them were in the same boat as me. A number of people I worked in the office with have died since. Two have died one directly from alcohol, one indirectly. A couple of others have, if they weren't alcoholics, they were heavy drinkers. There wasn't a great deal of discussion, except one bloke. I remember saying to one bloke one night, a guy named Peter Stanley, that when I first started in this branch, a promotion I got not long after, or just before Glenn was born, fellow I worked with, he was my offsider, this Peter Stanley, and we had a couple of other connections. I knew he was Catholic, and he came from Manly Way, as a matter of fact. Anyway, one night we were sitting in the Lismore Hotel, and I said to him something. I said, oh, you know, I just don't, you know, I just, every day's a drag. It's just a battle to get through every day. And I said to him, Pete, maybe I'm an alcoholic. And he said, don't be bloody silly. He said, you only drink beer. And I said to myself, oh, of course. I mean, that feeling propped me up for another half an hour, another hour, another night, another day. I only drink beer. There must be something else wrong. And that's quite common. You hear that in AA. People, AA alcoholics, think they've got some known, or, well, I thought mine was unknown, some unknown bloody medical problem no one else had. So, poor me, you'd feel sorry for yourself, that unknown illness you've got, so that'd sustain another bout of drinking. If that, I know that's stupid, but that's exactly how the thinking was.
Nancy, did you speak to anyone about this prior to Tony going away? Did you speak to your friends?
No, never. It was very private. I hid it. I was always terrified that Tony would come up the street in broad daylight blind and that my neighbours would see him. I was embarrassed by it. I really didn't know how to handle it. I think I just thought that, you know, perhaps it would settle in time, but as time went on, of course, I realised it didn't. I didn't know who to turn to. I knew that we both needed help. Tony's father, he thought the world of. And he had died. So I used to think, well, I can't speak to my father. My father used to drink. He wasn't alcoholic, but he, you know, had his bouts of heavy drinking. And I thought, there's no way I can speak to him. And it was really, I just didn't know where to turn. And fortunately, I'd had, even though I wasn't a Catholic, I'd had good associations with the local priest. And as I said before, that having spoken to him before, knowing Tony had spoken to him before about his drinking, I felt that the ice had broken. But when Vince came around to see Tony, I can remember ringing him before I came home to see if he'd been around. And he said, yes, I have been, you know, and he's going to go to a meeting with me tonight. So fine. So I knew before I came home that, you know, a little bit of the gone on. And when he was going to meetings with Vince, that was great. And even when Tony was saying that coming in at all hours, at first couple of times I worried a bit. But I thought, no, he's with Vince and he's sober. He's sober. So it didn't matter what time. The times when I did worry, and I think in those first couple of years, they were probably nearly as bad as the drinking times. Because little things like he'd go down the road to buy a paper, walk down the road. And I'd say, Glenn, go with Dad, go for a walk. Take Glenn for a walk. I'd always have to send one of the kids with him because I never trusted. I couldn't trust him. I couldn't trust myself. I couldn't allow myself to trust him because I just didn't want to be hurt. I didn't want to be disappointed. I didn't want to find the times he'd gone down to buy a paper, he was in the pub. So people around here, really, my neighbours didn't know. My family didn't know for a long while that he'd gone to AA. Everyone knew he had a problem. But, you know, they didn't know. And my neighbours around here, I think some of the ones that have moved since, I think they still wouldn't know. I never told them. Then when Tony started to go to Mount Pritchard group on a regular basis. There was an Al-Anon group up there, and Vince and Pat, his wife, Pat was involved in the Al-Anon group. She was secretary up there. They're always very keen for me to go there, but with three little boys, it was very hard. So they arranged with their daughter's fiance's family, a young girl who was still at school, but, you know, much older than my children, of course. They arranged for her to come round and sit with my three children for a couple of hours so I could go to the Mount Pritchard Al-Anon groups. And that was great. That was terrific. And I think that was the first time that I was able to open up, because here were people in the same position as me. Whereas I could never let my peers or my neighbours know. I was too embarrassed. So then, probably as we go on, we opened, there was a group opened down at the behind the church hall, an AA group, and following that, an Al-Anon group opened. I was secretary of that for quite a while. And found it very satisfying and helpful. And I could see what some of these women and men, we did have a man come there whose wife was had gone to AA. We did have a man. He didn't stay very long because he was... I don't think he liked to see his wife sober, but he really didn't want to be associated. It was a bit of a stigma to be associated with AA or Al-Anon. But, you know, I'd see some of these women come in and listen to them, and I think, you know, it was identical to my feelings. I was just sorry I didn't know about Al-Anon before Tony gave up drinking. When he was drinking, I think it would have been helpful. And perhaps he might have got to AA quicker. Probably not, but still, I've often wondered whether he would have got to AA quicker if I had been involved in Al-Anon and had to handle the situation. But I guess in AA and Al-Anon they say that you have to be at rock bottom to get any help, and we're very fortunate that we both hit rock bottom about the same time. I'd had enough and he'd had enough. So
what happened after that bus, Tony, at the pub?
Oh, that was a bit prior AA. But I recognised that, you know, after a little while in AA, I heard someone about busing me. And I've always considered that was my bus, you know. I had a couple of those. I had about three or four more goes in the 6 months. And I recognised what they were, but I couldn't stay sober because I wasn't happy about it. Now, AA provides the happy part, the happiness part, because they've got a program. You've got the support and you've got a program. And you're happy to be sober. Nance was saying too, I didn't realise that she used to get the kids to come with me. I mean, I just thought that was great, being able to. Mind you, these things, you don't become well overnight. And for a long while, my body was, giving me hell from time to time. And I still didn't have... I didn't have a great deal of tolerance and I didn't have a great deal of patience because it was like... It's like you stir something up, you know. You've got to wait for it to settle. If you're in a bubble or something, you know, stir it right up. You've got to wait for it all to settle. Well, that can take years. Even the first part took a few months before you go into the honeymoon period, which I went through like most do.
What's the honeymoon period?
Well, it's like that stops. All the aches and pains stop. And in that period, it seems that no one can make a mistake. They can't get themselves in the trough. They don't drink. Everything is so clear, and everything is you feel so well again. But that doesn't last long. I wouldn't trust myself to go into a hotel. I quickly lost contact with the people down at the Green Valley Hotel because. When I went along and I heard some bloke say one night, boots and all. And I said, there, that's got to be me. But what's boots and all mean? I didn't know. It didn't mean much in my case. But I do recognise one thing, Therese, you mentioned about the bust. You see, then I could pinpoint it. Right. I heard a little cliche, if you don't want a haircut, don't sit in the bloody barber's chair. Right. And I said to someone, what's he talking about? And they said, well, if you don't want to drink, don't go to a pub. I said, oh, but all my mates down there. I said, well, how many of your mates have been around to see you? It's only a couple of weeks or 3 weeks. How many of your mates have rang up and asked, are you crook or something? Why aren't you at the pub? I thought about it. Now, most of the guys I knew were good blokes, you know, and none of them said, oh, why haven't I been drinking? But when I did make contact, no. But I did not trust myself. Even though I went for a walk at lunchtime at work, I wouldn't walk to old haunts and I wouldn't walk past a pub. I kept remembering that night I went there to give them the money from that Cornella ride back for the syndicate and finished up, you know, coming home Sunday afternoon or some blessed bloody thing, you know. So I said, I just don't trust myself. And of course, all this time we're discussing these things with Vince in particular. That's the beauty about it. You don't get left with your own thoughts. You air them, and you can talk. And the older, as they say now, the older sober members will say to you, hey, forget that one, but that's a good one. You know, do that. Fine, if you don't want to walk across the pub, cross the bloody road and walk on the other, and then cross back again. You might wear your shoes out quicker, but that's about all you'll do. but you're doing yourself a favour. So that's the way it had to be. I just didn't trust myself to go in a pub. I didn't for a fair while. I didn't go in a, purposely. I was never a club man. I didn't trust myself to go into a pub. And, you know, and that was the educational part of the sponsor from Vince. And others, Alan Smith, lived around the road. Again, I mention a surname simply because Alan passed on too. And up the hill, great support from Father Gallagher. Now, Father Gallagher was one that was a bit of controversial parish priest, but a great advocate of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the people are in trouble.
Was he at Mount Pritchard?
He was at Mount Pritchard, and he was under the old system. He had a lifetime appointment, and they tried to remove him from. And he's told them they weren't going to. In so many words. In fact, there was a papal protest. There was a protest to Rome, lodged, I think, by and endorsed, not lodged by, endorsed by Cardinal Gilroy.
So Alan Smith, where did he live?
He lived in Hoxton Park Road, Cartwright, or on the corner of what was the name? Selwyn Place, and Hoxton Park. Alan was a real battler. Don't think everyone was sure of his birth date or anything. He was just one of those people that enigma. But I was told, I didn't actually see him, but when he got to AA, some of the people who were there said this bloke won't make it. He's too far gone, because he was actually at one stage living under the Harbour Bridge. He'd gone on to Mefo. Drank meth and everything, and they just said he wouldn't make it. Well, Alan wants to prove him so much wrong, because, and when he was sober, he was always very well dressed. You know, and he held down a job in town.
Superannuation board
he worked for, and he was just a real. How would you explain him, Nance? Everyone would know it and be aware of him around the area, one way or the other. If he wasn't drinking, he used to love to whistle. He didn't care where he whistled. Craig, that's our second son, he was working in town, and I used to try and dodge Alan on the train of a morning because of Alan's whistling, one thing, you know. And then one particular, Craig, I remember one time he was telling us he thought he dodged Al, and he got on the train, and next from up the back of the carriage, Alan spied him, and he got out to go, "Hey, Butch!" And Butch didn't want to look around, because everyone on the train looked and said, because Alan was just, completely at ease with the world when he wasn't drinking. Unfortunately, Alan had a couple of slips. Now, here's a man at 8 years sobriety. I didn't witness this, but one Christmas he picked up a drink. 8 days later, he was in Vetrick Hospital, Summer Hill, and they got a priest to anoint him because they didn't think he was going to live through the night. So that's a very bad equation, isn't it? 8 days for 8 years. Other times, his tolerance was zero. If he had a Beck's powder, he'd be gone. A lot of people around there, Margaret Taylor was where he used to work at the post office. She used to keep an eye out on him. She used to see Alan a lot. As I say, if Alan, really anyone who worked around the shop near would know him, because when he was around, he talked to everyone. He whistled, he couldn't help himself. He was a compulsive talker. He even talked in his bloody sleep. I mean, all the time. And he'd yell out, "Hoi!" We had him stay here for a while. Or anyway, you'd be sound asleep in the middle of the night, and this loud hoyer after the household would jump, start on what the heck was going on, you know. But that was just Al. And Margaret, a couple of times, I've virtually seen him crawl and be unable to crawl. Because he didn't have the physical strength to crawl. This is after, say, a drink or two drinks. So bad was his tolerance in his system had completely been eroded.
How old was he?
Well, no one's sure, but he was middle 60s, early 60s, and then he was middle 60s. But he battled on, and unfortunately, his family life broke up And when that broke up, it was amazing. You know, Father Gell once said to Vince, I won't say this, you can't tell him this, because no one in AA will give you self-pity. That's the one thing that, no one will give you a kick in the ass before they'll give you and let you have a self-pity. Because anyway, Father Gell once said, well, I'll never tell him, Vince, but I don't know how that bastard stays sober with what he's got to put up with. So that sort of epitomises what Alan was. The finish of his life. Now, without AA, Alan would never have got X amount of years. A lot of years wouldn't have, he would never made it, along with a lot of others, including myself. But Alan would have not made much more. It was an act of God to, when Alan got to AA, because he couldn't have had much time left on the earth the way he was going. After he lost his wife and the family and...
Well, prior, all right. Just leading up to that, my first connection with Alan, you know, was through AA and Al-Anon, and through his wife Joan with Al-Anon. She used to come to Al-Anon. Now, listening to her, Alan went through the war and in the jungle, she used to mix his own drink and boot polish and all the rest of it. And now Joan met Alan as a sober alcoholic. He'd been in AA for some X amount of years, and she met him as a sober alcoholic. So she'd never seen him in drink at all. They got married. They had a daughter. Then a friend of theirs in AA, husband and wife, were both alcoholic. They had a daughter. Now, they were both very badly affected by alcohol, the husband and wife. So Joan and Alan took this other girl and reared her as their own. Now, Joan had only been married something like 18 months, and here she's got a husband and two little girls. And they, you know, went along for some years like this, and Alan would go to his meetings and was sober, and, you know, and their life had the ups and downs of anyone. Then they had a son, and then after so many years, Alan had a bust, and Joan really didn't know how to handle it, because she'd never known Alan with drink. She'd only ever known a sober Alan. And when Alan drank, as Tony was saying, now the girls would buy him aftershave. He would drink his aftershave lotion. Anything at all that had a smell of alcohol, any description, he would drink. Once he started to drink, that was the end of it. Many's the time that he would be in such a state. Joan and I remember one particular time, he was an absolute mess. And we had a station wagon at that time. And I was driving with Joan and I were taking him over to Concord Hospital, Repat. And we had to put the back down of the car, and he laid there. And it wasn't funny, but it was funny at the time. We'd drive around a corner and we'd hear Alan roll from one side of the van to the other, go around the next corner, and he'd roll. And then every so often he'd stick his head out and say, "You got lovely hair." And you think, so we laughed, we had to laugh. As soon as we get to the hospital, Alan would, we'd have to run in and get someone to come and bring him a wheelchair out or a stretcher or something, because he just couldn't stand, he couldn't scratch himself. And but he'd get into that wheelchair or on that stretcher, and the change in that man's face, he was just so grateful for any help. And that happened many, many times. Joan and I would take him to St John of God at Richmond.
What period of time was this, Nancy? Get a sense of that again. I mean, this was ongoing.
This was ongoing. I'm just trying to think of years.
Probably one stage of the early 70s, early middle 70s.
Yes, yes. I would say that our daughter Dana would have been born by that stage.
Yeah, Dana was born because, Dana was, very attached to Dana.
Loved Dana.
Yeah, he loved her. And, he did spoil her because he kept bringing a gift every Sunday. He'd come around for dinner on a Sunday night, and Nance free up saying to him, "Look, Alan, you we want you to come, I want you to come, but you've got to stop this, you know. Oh, he said, but she said, no, not so much for you, Al, as for her. She's getting to expect it of a Sunday night, you know. And if you don't turn up, she's going to be disappointed. He'd bring her a doll. I mean, he didn't just bring her a small thing. He'd bring her a doll and all sorts of things, wouldn't he? All sorts of things. But he just loved Dana. So she was only... So he would have been already had one of the busts, you know, yeah. And he did have a few. I mean, one of his busts there, he didn't even drink grog. He started off by taking these heminurin tablets, which they give alcoholics. I think they help the nerves and everything. Well... We went around to his place. Now, this must be later on because I'm sure there was no one living there under him. Yeah. And we found all these things hidden everywhere. He'd been to a doctor over the North Sydney way somewhere and got Scribner ink for him, and he was taking these tablets. Now, you'd swear blind that he'd had about 50 schooners. Yeah. I mean, we couldn't get into the house at first because he was on the floor and he couldn't open the door for us. I forget how we actually got in that particular one. We must have eventually got him to come to the door.
This became, after a period of time, Joan put up with a lot of busts, and he was a complete mess each time. And after a period of time, the marriage broke up. And with the marriage breaking up, the girls were old enough, they went their own way, and we actually had Tim, the boy, living here with us for 9-12 months. He actually lived with us and went to school with our boys. So we were sort of rearing him in a sense for that period of time. And then he eventually went back to his mother. His mother found somewhere else to live. She moved out of the house. Then Alan started... He then associated himself with a group called Who's, who then they put him into these centres and whatever. Anyway, in between his going to hospitals and Who's, he rented his home out to someone. Then when he got himself back to a stable position, he didn't have anywhere to go. So that's when he came and lived with us. So we had Alan here living with us for, might have been another 12 months. And that was when Tony was saying about the times when he'd go on the train with Butch. Butch would get on the same bus with him and then try to lose him because, he was sober, but he was so loud and whatever, and Butch was a very embarrassed type of boy.
That age.
Exactly. He'd want to hide. But we had Alan here, as I say, for, a period of about 12 months living with us. We seemed to get all astray. We've had quite a number of people live with us at various times. We're always...
Is that related to addictions of some sort or just...
I think it was... We're in a situation where perhaps we had been through so much and we appreciated what we had.
You had experienced it, perhaps?
Oh, yeah, in not as severe a way as these people, but, we just sort of opened our house out for them to come in and stay with us. And then eventually Alan hired a caravan and he put it on in his backyard in the house of Cartwright that he was renting out. And he lived in that for a while, and then the girl he was renting it out with was frightened of him. Now, Alan was the most harmless person, but if you didn't know him, his drink could put you off. Mm. And she was frightened of him, and she moved out. So Alan then moved into the house. He made a complete and utter mess of it. We used to go around and take meals round to him and check on him, and as Tony said, I don't know how we got in this day, and he was an absolute mess on these tablets, and they were everywhere. And then he used to smoke very heavily. He actually went to Seventh-day Adventists and did something like 7 of their non-smoking, quit-smoking courses. So he wasn't a good advertisement for them. He used to smoke, chain-smoke Camel cigarettes.
Where did he grow up?
What's his background?
Don't know. We're really unsure.
Don't know.
I think there was some suggestion he was actually born in New Zealand. Never... I remember Vince even saying, like, Vince was, we couldn't ascertain, couldn't pinpoint any real facts, to go up.
He ended up with the to sum him up in. We were always frightened that he would burn something, or we'd find him in the gutter or whatever. And there was one time there that he came around here, and I think he was actually sober at the time, and he'd been smoking in bed, and someone saw some smoke coming out the window and actually dragged the mattress out of the window. And then, so we really thought that's how he would die. But he went down to Goulburn to whose? Or Grow? Grow, was it?
Grow
or whose? Anyway, and did this course down there. And it was very tough. They used to sort of have them out in the open in the middle of winter and have to go down to the well to get water. And I mean, he was a very frail man. But this was part of the program or whatever. So he did that. And then he had a clot in his leg, and they put him in to operate on it. And he died under the operation, which was probably the best way he could go, because we were sure he was going to burn that house down. That house actually was gutted, was burnt out at one stage, and I think that's when he had to move and he had to go in with this group. And that house in Cartwright then was, as I say, a burnt wreck, but it was sold for an absolute song once Alan died. When he died, the family just up and sold it. And whoever bought it, I mean, they bought a burnt place, but it's, you know, they would have got it for nearly nothing.
Nance mentioned about that mattress. Oh, look, you wouldn't believe it. I think it had more than 40 different burn marks on it. Might have been more than 60. I think we were away one time, two young blokes walking past his place after midnight, one Saturday night, I think it was, saved his life. I can't remember if he was sober or he'd been drinking, but in any case, they managed to pull him out of the house, and he was admitted to hospital with smoke inhalation. He dropped a cigarette into the mattress with him laying on it, and... So how it never flamed to the extent where it would have taken his life, it was just, you know, I don't know.
But it was incredible with this area. Everyone knew Alan, and so many people knew that we were connected with him in some way. And we would get phone calls from people we really didn't know very well, and they'd ring up and say, look, Alan's... down in the gutter or Alan somewhere. And there was like a protective society protecting him, you know, and it was great.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, people really looked after. I remember one time I went down there and Margaret Taylor said, oh, did you see Alan? Where? She said, oh, he was out there. And I'd walked from the car park at the back of the hotel, see, and I don't remember what I was doing. I must have been either reading or started or thinking or something. So I said, no, I hadn't seen him. So I went back out and down near O'Brien Hall. There he was in the... And you're like, you hear about, but here he was in the gutter. In the gutter. Now, I managed to get him up. I got him up because he wasn't all that heavy. And I got him home. Later on, the bloke said to me, I don't remember who it was. Mate, he said, is that man sick? I said, well, you could say that. He said, because he only had two drinks in the hotel. He only had two beers, two mitties of beer. He said, oh, you know, and then I saw you get him out of the, pick him up out of the gutter over there. He said, oh, he must be something wrong with him other than that. Yeah, I said, there is. No, I didn't have time. But that was it. Two beers, two mitties of beer. And he was prostrate, trying to get up, and was going nowhere. He was conscious, but he just never had the ability to come up. We missed him another time. We all of a sudden we missed him, and we were somewhere. It was a guy around the road, an AA man, Lloyd. I remember this Lloyd and Freddie, and where's that bloody Smithy? And so it was a funny thing. He was one person in AA that the people seemed to know his surname, because everyone bandied around, you know, as Nancy was just explained to you, there's so many people in the area knew him, you know, Alan Smith, they all knew Alan Smith. And we went around his place. It was winter, I remember it was freezing, bloody cold. And we're looking, and at the last minute, no, he's not there, oh my God, where is he? At the last minute, we heard a whimper or a little noise, and we looked in, and we again had to work. And I think that particular time, I think Freddie broke a window out the back to open the back door, because Alan couldn't get the door and open for us. It was freezing cold, and there he was with a bloody singlet on, that's all. And he's, you know, and there wasn't much, there was nothing left in the house at the finish. There's no carpets, it was there, love.
Wow.
And, you know, he was he was like that, and he was frozen. He was blue. He was absolutely blue when we got him besides his other problems. And yet, you know, the same guy. He would do anyone to help, do anything to help anyone that needed, especially AA need or any other need. Alan would do anything. He'd give you anything. He's done it. I've seen him do it, you know. Just a big nigger. He was a compulsive talker. In football, just a little bit of a football used to be new on the television Sunday afternoon. Now, as Nance will confirm with you, I went through a stage where I would not have a radio on in the house of a Sunday afternoon because I wanted to watch the football replay. You see, so there was no way I wanted to score. So. One particular time, Alan comes. He comes around for Sunday dinner, and yep, and he comes in. And he says, "It was South Sydney was on. He also barracked for South Sydney. South got beat, mate. So I had a word with him. Now look, Al, I got quite cranky, really, and I think Nancy actually had the word. Don't tell the football score. We want to watch it because he wouldn't do this. He had to listen. You see, he couldn't wait. He was that impetuous, he couldn't wait. All right, mate, all right, he agreed to it. So he still come around for dinner. Now, there was only one caper I discovered. I discovered by chance. If South Sydney were playing, I knew the moment Alan walked in the door whether they won or lost. Because if they won, he'd come up the side whistling. I found out if they didn't win, he'd come up and wouldn't, you know, he'd have a long face. I think he broke me of the habit. I gave up, you know. I said, oh, well, you know, there's no way of stopping him. I mean, he just couldn't hide. He was a guy that, you know, he wore his heart on his sleeve and he didn't look at his face to know how he was, you know. He was a man that had realised what a great need there was for Alcoholics Anonymous. Very supportive of meetings, especially any new meeting locally. Alan would, while he was travelling, he would make sure he would get there, you know. Early days with Vince and me and Alan, we used to have a great thing. Besides one or two others, we'd go to a meeting of a Saturday night. But we wouldn't pick where we were going until late Saturday afternoon. We'd all meet and say, right, Vince, the only Vince's car, right, and we'd pick one where we're going, you know. And while I think of it, Alan had a beautiful little cliche saying he used to say in AA when he spoke. At the end of his talk, he would say, I thank God for AA and AA for God. And, you know, that's it. He meant it, you know. No one's ever, people used to say it while he was around, but they never said it since he went. It's a fair while since he went now. I've got no idea. It must be, oh, goodness gracious, it must be 15, it must be maybe 18 or 19 years since he died, which is a long time when you say it like that. The need for AA in the area was recognised by another person, in particular, a number of others in AA, and subsequently a guy named Eddie from up Heckenberg asked me, what would only be 1971, wouldn't it? 71, I think. 71 there, middle, late 71. He wanted to know, AA use a lot of church halls. Now, it's not because it's any connection with religion. It's because that they're generally so generous to us, they only charge a very small fee to use the hall. Only a couple of dollars, you know. And they're happy, like Vince introducing himself to Father Muldoon, making himself sort of, in a sense, their services available. Well, thank God he did in my case. Thank God he did. And you generally find all the priests and ministers and reverends, they're all very receptive to this. They recognise the worth of having someone that they can call on. Well, I seen Father Muldoon. Father Muldoon put me in touch with a Sister Darcy, and I arranged for a meeting with Eddie and Sister Darcy, and that's when the Green Valley, it's called Green Valley, meeting opened, and I'm pretty sure it was middle or late 71, or if not early 72, and it's still going strong, and it uses the club rooms at the back of the St. Therese Church, Sadly and Miller. Certainly with obviously the blessing of the parish priest and the nuns, and that meeting is still going. The meeting at Mount Pritchard, Vince Johnson restarted that in I believe about 67 or 68, I think it was 67, I'm not real sure, 67, 68. It's gone through a phase where we've had a lot of members from various times meets on a Friday night. I've been secretary of that over the years for approximately 18 or 19 years. Doesn't mean you don't have to do a great deal, but you've got to be available, you've got to be there, you've got to open up. It's always had the support of whatever priest has been up there, especially when Father Gallo was there, but the others certainly too. And it's still run up at the area. Now it's moved over the road, quite comfortable and good. Well, furnished and what's the word?
Decked out
facilities. You've even got the own two female and male toilet inside. You know, well, it used to be the old classrooms, and the kids, the local kids, were forever breaking the windows, and we'd go there on a meeting night in winter, and I'm not joking, the wind would be whistling because not every window on the place was broken. Like, they just gave up on fixing windows. I don't blame them. And it was a really old building, but it was special. And you know, it was amazing. We used to have more people come to those meetings in winter when it was in addition like that than when we got all the comforts. So, you know, maybe that's just another part of the madness of alcoholics and alcoholism.
I'll just ask you something before the tape finishes.
Yes.
Just in terms of numbers, is Green Valley, like, has it, do they go in peaks and lows?
Or yes,
like,
yes.
Can you describe that and maybe if that means anything?
Or? Well, I can describe it, Therese, that your meetings go up and down. It's like most other things, though, like even sporting bodies. Sometimes you have quite a number of coming and attending and supporting and being participating. Same thing with AA meetings. And then you might have, I've been up there many times. I've been up to Mount Pritchard. Don't think so, Green Valley, but I've been the only one there. Well, there's been another one. And then next week there's 25. But there's no rhyme or reason. It's the willy-nilliness of, again, of the alcoholic. Maybe that's why on that Saturday I was talking about, that we never made up our mind to set where we're going that night. Maybe that applies for a lot of people. They either go or they don't go. If you're... A couple of weeks ago, I know the mate of mine, a secretary up there now, he wasn't very happy, but he doesn't fail to let everyone know if he's not happy either. The State of Origin was on. Well, he got one bloke there besides himself, right? The week before he'd had 14, the week after he had 15 or something. So the other night, the last State of Origin, well, there was actually six of us, but when I knocked off work, I still had time to go to the meeting. Green Valley meetings always had pretty good numbers. Part of it, I think, is because of the area, the immediate area that it caters for, if you put it that way, availability to people. Another thing is they do have a slightly different timetable to the others. Most meetings are run from 8 o'clock to 9:30. Green Valley go from 7:30 to 9. And being a Sunday night, that appeals to a lot of people too. Gives them a get home quite early, you know, if they've got to get back up and go to work the next day.
Are you still involved, Nancy, at all?
No.
Were you involved? Was that at Green Valley?
Started my involvement at Mount Pritchard, mm-hmm. and then moved the involvement down to Green Valley when the Al-Anon group opened there. And I guess my involvement ceased. Probably when it closed. The Al-Anon group did close. And I think that we'd had a daughter at that stage. And I think with the three boys and the baby, it just became too much, too difficult for me to get there every Sunday night to get someone to mind her. But the involvement kept up as far as the contact or the helping. I wasn't able to go to the meetings, but then once our village care centre was formed, I think the Al-Anon, what I'd learnt at Al-Anon, then was very helpful in talking to other people and even directing them where they should go for help, because I couldn't give them the help, but at least I knew where to send them to for that help.
Once again, Myra,
yep.
I'm going to just mention the Vertiphone, but Nancy just said something. It was a very difficult time for everyone. But this is the disease of alcoholism. I don't believe that there's a family can go unscathed. We have seen instances where someone in the family, other than the practicing alcoholic, be more affected, actually be in a worse state than the alcoholic. Nance also just mentioned that people don't find that hard to understand, and that's understandable too, that they're not the one drinking. How come you're telling me you can't on this? Well, unfortunately, this is part of this insidious disease. I worked for a time on the Divertiphone roster. People, head office didn't have enough people to man the phones for 24 hours a day. So after 5 o'clock in the evening, they used to turn them over to your phone at home so you could do it from your house. Now, I found that extremely different. You got some straight up and down. Could you tell me where a meeting is? Fine, you only have to consult your list. Blah, blah, blah. But then if you've got someone that was drinking,